Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You'll do anything to keep your vehicle happy. Let's make sure it stays running smoothly. With eBay Guaranteed Fit, you'll find the right parts that fit your vehicle the first time. From air filters to headlights to batteries and bumpers. When you see the green check, you know that part will fit. Get the right parts at the right prices. Head to ebaymotors.com. Let's ride. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
America's number one motorcycle insurer is ready to ride. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year. And they keep things affordable with discounts like Paid in Full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. Get a quote today at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Premium is for state minimum liability coverage. Rate and discounts not available in all states or situations.
Hello and welcome to episode 224 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today in the podcast, we welcome Popeye Vogelzang from Farside, your favorite train wreck, and a new band he's in called Calling Hours. Popeye is most well known for being a guitarist and vocalist of the band Farside, founded in Orange County, California in 1989, and released most of their records on Revelation. Farside played a ton with hardcore bands, punk bands, emo throughout their life. We talk about his musical family, hardcore, his interesting life after full-time music by being a well-known voice actor, and much more. Popeye is a legend in the scene and someone I've wanted on to have on for a very, very long time. This is episode 224 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Popeye Vogelzang from Calling Hours, your favorite train wreck, and Farside.
KROQ, they eventually became, super corporate alternative music radio station. But I remember in like the very, very early 80s, they played a lot of unique and interesting stuff and a lot of indie stuff. In particular, there was a show that was on Sunday nights by a DJ named Rodney Bingenheimer, and he had a show called Rodney on the Rock, and he put out multiple vinyl compilation records of all these super obscure bands that many of which are still obscure to this day. But to be able to, it was a little easier to have access to alternative types of music because it was a weird radio station. It was back when DJs were allowed to play whatever the heck they wanted to. But also, just by luck, I grew up in Huntington Beach, California, in Orange County, which was a massive hotbed of very early West Coast punk rock. With bands like the Vandals and Social Distortion and the Adolescents, and I was still a kid, so I barely had a concept of any of it. But I did have an older brother and an older sister, and they also had really cool friends. And so a lot of that music would kind of filter its way into our house when my brother or sister would come home because one of their cool friends lent them a record, and we'd put it on the family hi-fi. And I again had no concept of it, but somehow I got hooked to it. And that being said, I've always loved pop music. We were a very musical family. Everybody played an instrument. There was always some form of music playing somewhere in the house. We used to love doing sing-alongs in the car when we would go on road trips. So I already had a love of music before I discovered punk. But then once I discovered punk when I was around 10 years old, it just kind of started me on a different sort of path.
Can you talk about the family again? Like, what did you kind of, I mean, my parents listened to music, but it wasn't like everyone played an instrument, or, I mean, what was that kind of, did you feel anything, or was that just your life? Because I mean, I would go to other friends' house and see, you know, their parents playing or something and kind of see a difference. Do your friends realize, like, oh, man, your whole family's down with music?
No, I think the way you put it, it was just our life. It was just our life. We just loved music, but I was the only one that ever pursued it as far as like playing in a band or anything. And I guess I only thought it was weird if I went over to a friend's house and they weren't listening to music or they weren't playing instruments, you know. And it's mm-hmm. not like my family got together and had like jam sessions or anything. We just, you know, I don't know. It was just kind of something that was always a part of it. It always existed. It was always there. But to me, we just seemed totally normal. It's not like we were bohemians or hippies or anything like that. It was a very, very, very standard suburban middle-class upbringing. And we just happened to enjoy music. My dad was a big, fan of jazz and jazz fusion. Mm-hmm. My mom's a massive Frank Sinatra fan. I can't say whether or not any of that really filtered down into my songwriting influences necessarily, but I still have a great appreciation for that kind of stuff.
What were some of those early instruments? Was it first singing that you kind of got into? Was it guitar?
No, piano.
Everybody played piano. Nice.
Yeah. Everybody played piano. I couldn't tell you why, but that was the thing. We had a piano. It was this upright piano that my older sister still has in storage. My dad played piano. My mom played piano, and so when we were growing up, we took piano lessons. Even though I desperately wanted to be Peter Criss from Kiss.
Oh, really?
And I wanted to be a drummer. Oh, yeah. I dressed up like him so many times, whether it was Halloween or not. I wanted to be Peter Criss. And my parents, like, totally put the kibosh on it. They were like,
oh, really?
Why don't you learn how to play a real instrument? Later I realized, oh, yeah, piano's not quite as noisy as playing the drums. And we already have a piano, and drums are expensive. So I get it.
I love that they were like, hey, wait a minute. Let's steer you here.
They were super rational and intelligent about it. It wasn't like they yelled at me. I was like, come on, can I please get a drum set? Mike, let's think about this for a minute. I was like, all right. I mean, I guess you're paying for the lessons. other than that, I think my brother tried to play trumpet for a little while. None of us ever took singing lessons. The way I learned how to play guitar is, my sister wanted a guitar for Christmas one year. And so my parents got her this acoustic guitar, and she just didn't take to it at all. Mm-hmm. And so after a little while, my brother asked, hey, if you're not doing anything with that, can I start fiddling around with it? And so he just taught himself how to play.
Wow.
He's just a brilliant guy like that. He not through like music books or anything. He would just listen along to the radio or records that he liked and just figured out what note was what. and him being my older brother, me emulating him so much, which I still do, after a while I was like, so wait a minute, you just taught yourself how to do that? Maybe I can teach myself how to do that. So when I was around 12 or so, when he wasn't looking, I would sneak into his bedroom and grab my sister's old guitar and do the same thing that he did and just listen to the radio, listen to records that I liked and figured out what note was right and what note was wrong. And I guess the same thing applies to singing. You hear a note and you match it. And yep. That's how you learn.
Yeah.
That's how I learned, at least.
That's beautiful.
A lot of people have asked, like, hey, can you teach me how to play guitar? No, I cannot. Because I don't know how I learned it. There's no freaking way I could teach you or anybody how to do it. I've tried a couple of times, and it turns out to be this kind of frustrating thing where I'm like, okay, you take this finger and you put it here and you put this other finger there and you just play. Like, what's complicated about that? I consider myself extremely lucky that I was able to learn how to do any of that kind of stuff, in addition to everything I got to do with Farside and all the other musical projects that I got to do.
Yeah. What about some first shows for you? This is awesome.
Oh yeah. I could absolutely tell you. Farside's third show was opening for Judge, this huge show at the Country Club in Reseda, California. We were the very, very first opening band, and we got paid $50.
That seems fair.
Judge.
Seems fair.
Oh my God. We thought it may as well have been like $100,000. Like, we felt like we were like, dude, $50 split four ways. Oh my God. Like, you know, we were all like 19 years old at the time, and we were kind of walking around like, all right, who wants to know me?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a blast. I mean, we were all nervous as hell. I don't even think we met Judge at the show. I know I would have been way too nervous to go introduce myself. I still kind of am in those situations, but I mean, it didn't make me feel like, all right, we've made it as a band. Like, I just couldn't believe that we got to do that. And it's definitely one of those things. In the moment, you realize it's awesome, and decades later, you could still look back and think, my God, your third show ever. In a band that, like, this is the first band that you've ever sung for, and your third show, you're opening for this huge legendary New York hardcore band, and you're getting 1/4 of $50 to do it. Holy crap.
Yeah. Still to this day, you have that saved somewhere. You don't have.
I think I spent it on a Moons Over My Hammy at Denny's later that evening or something.
What about shows yourself going to them early, maybe if it was high school or middle school?
The first like show that I went to, it wasn't until I was a freshman in high school. Because frankly, I was just too scared. even though I had been into punk and hardcore for a long time. Or, I mean, not a long time, but at least a decent number of years to where I felt like I, you know, I had my records and I was into certain things, but I was still a skinny little twerp and, you know, a non-combatant. And you would hear stories from your buddies who would go to shows and like, oh man, there was this crazy fight with a skinhead and a suicidal and, oh, and that's fun. How, you know, like, so right. I just shied away from it until I think eventually one of my friends probably grabbed me by the earlobe and said, all right, come on, let's go see a show. And it lived up to be one of the more frightening experiences that I've ever been part of. Lots of fights. And
do you remember who it was?
It was Uniform Choice. And No For An Answer. I think Half Off played. And it was at Fender's Ballroom in Long Beach, California, which lived up to its reputation of being just a sketchy, big place, but that's one of the few places that would actually put on shows like that in a terrible neighborhood. And one of those places where you lied to your parents about where you were going that
yeah.
night. And, and everybody kind of kept their eye on one another. And then you think, yeah, this is awesome. I'm going to just take a few steps back and just kind of hide in the corner and watch from afar. Cause I don't want to come home with, with after a visit to the emergency room. And then I was concerned about getting my ass kicked for no reason. And I was concerned about having to explain to my mom where I had been and what happened to me.
Right. What about forming bands, playing music? Was Farside the first one that you formed or that you were a part of? Or were there, obviously there's probably some ones that happen along the way, but that one kind of stuck.
Sure. I was in a band, right before Farside. I played guitar for a band called Borderline, which was a hardcore band, and we put out a 7-inch on Conversion Records.
Oh yeah.
Which was run by Dennis Remsing. Dennis was the drummer. I was the guitar player. We didn't do too much. I did that. And then prior to that, when I was in high school, I was in a punk/hardcore band called Bottom Line. No relation. just with some friends from high school, and we never played a single show. We just practiced a lot, and we recorded a demo, and then everybody graduated and kind of moved on to different directions. So that's my musical pedigree prior to Farside.
Fantastic. More than most. More than most.
I suppose, yeah.
So what, again, before 89, when it was formed, like, the you kind of were like, okay, I want to do this. Like, was there school that you left, or was there decisions that you kind of remember that kind of led you down to go like, no, I think I want to do this? Or was it just as other things were happening? Because other people, sometimes they have a part-time job and then it turns into something. Like, everyone's got their own. So what was your sort of part before that?
It was my first year out of, when I joined Farside, it was my first year out of high school. I was going to college, and I was working at a gas station. I never really had any dreams or notions that music was something that I would ever commit to full time. I don't know, Tom, how old you are.
44.
So 44. Okay. So I'm 52. So there's a little bit of a hardcore generations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Move pretty
totally.
Quickly. And I'm not going to claim that I have my pulse on anything that's been going on in the hardcore scene currently. But from my perspective back then, you didn't tour full time. If you were in a hardcore band or a punk band, you had a day job, and most people went to college, and it was just kind of something you did on nights and weekends and on school breaks or when you had vacation time or whatever. So I don't remember definitely not at the beginning feeling like I had to make any sacrifices or make any big life changes to join Farside. What I can tell you is that I literally had to beg Rob Hayworth, who was the original founding member and original guitar player, to let me try out for the band.
Oh, really?
I mentioned that I was working at a gas station, and he pulled in and we were talking for a little bit, and I was like, hey, what's going on? And he said, oh, I'm doing this new band with, you know, a couple of guys, this guy and that guy, and you know, we're still trying to find a singer. And I said, well, can I try out? And he just kind of snickered, and he's like, you don't know how to sing. And I'm like, yeah, I do. I swear I know how to sing. Come on, dude. Like, he thought I was having him on. And I said, no, I promise you, I know how to sing. Like, can I try out? And he was like super, super hesitant. And then finally said, all right, I'll come back tomorrow or whatever and bring you a practice tape and maybe you can write some lyrics and show up the next time. And I was like, yeah, dude, that'll be great. And so he came back and gave me this cassette tape. And when he handed it to me, he asked again, do you really know how to sing, dude? And I'm like, yes, I promise you I can sing. And so, I went home and, maniacally scribbled out a bunch of lyrics, showed up to practice, and we went through, I think we had 5 songs at the time, and I sang through them and a couple of times. And I had one of those, old like, cassette recorders just to record it and for fun. Went through the songs a couple of times, and then we decided to take a break, and I went and got a soda or went to the bathroom or whatever. I forgot that I left the tape recorder running. And so when I came back from our break, they said, all right, dude, you're in. And I was like, yeah, that's great. Oh, I'm so excited. And then we, you know, played the songs a little bit more. And then I was listening to the tape on the way home, and I got to listen to what they were saying about me while we were on that break.
Oh, that's great. That helps for later relationships. That helps a lot.
Well,
I'm joking.
I'll tell you, it was, they weren't exactly jumping for joy. It wasn't the most flattering thing. You could hear the door close, ka-chunk. And then Rob turned to the other guys. He's like, so what do you guys think? And they're like, oh, yeah, I mean, I suppose. Just kind of muttering and murmuring. Like, oh, yeah. And then finally Rob said, so is he in or what? And there was just way too long of a pause before the other guys finally said, yeah, I guess it's all right. Yeah, okay, that's cool.
So that's that. Yeah, that's so resounding. I mean, that is a great. That, when you're at work and you get that review and there's a pause. Yeah. So you're feeling good on the way home.
Oh, I'll admit I was laughing. I was hysterically laughing because at that point I was just happy that like I was in the band. So like whatever, I think it kind of set the tone for, in a way, I think it definitely set the tone for Farside's attitude during our tenure, because we did a lot of things to make each other laugh and would recognize how much of a joke so many things were that we were involved in and that we did. And that was a significant moment for sure.
What did you guys agree on music wise? Or even talked about?
We never really talked about it. We just kind of went for it. Someone would show up with a song and, in the earlier days when Rob Hayworth was still with us, he pretty much wrote all of the music and I wrote all of the lyrics. Mm-hmm. But everyone would add their little bits and pieces here and there. So we just kind of followed whatever Rob wanted to do, basically. And Rob wrote good songs. And so we were like, yeah, that's great. Let's do it. And then after Rob left and Kevin Murphy joined the band, things definitely, I think it definitely broadened the spectrum of what we were doing, because then that's when I was able to write more music for the band. And, you know, so it was kind of like a 50-50 thing between Kevin and me. Like sometimes one of us would show up with a full song written from beginning to end. And other times it would be like, hey, I've got like half of this written, or I've got most of it written. Do you have another little part that you can stick in here? Or here's what I got, add whatever you think is going to work. But as far as citing specific bands and specific influences, I don't remember it ever really coming up like, we got to sound like this, or we don't want to sound like that. It was kind of hard to know what kind of music everybody else was into unless we were not at practice and we were in somebody's car and somebody said, hey, I'm going to pop this tape in. And, you know, like you know, like, hey, have you guys ever listened to this band? Nope. Oh, check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Or who wants to listen to this? Not me. I do. Okay. You know, and then you would get into debates about why that band rules or why that band sucks. But when we were at practice, other bands didn't really seem to come up. It was just kind of what we wanted to try to do with whatever we were trying to write, I guess.
Yeah. No, you're great at skirting around genres, because we're going to hit another one later that you're going to have to answer to. I'm joking. But
right.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking. But I think that's what's interesting about Farside as a band, when I heard it or someone shared it to me, is that one song sounded something, another song sounded differently, and your thoughts on, you know, you get on a label, you get pigeonholed somehow, and when you're not a hardcore band, I worked at Equal Vision Records. Every band we signed, they thought it sounds like Bane. And I'm like, no, this is actually a band that sounds like Wilco, you know, but it's just, there's this, you know, kind of a label. So if it was Crisis or Rev, did you feel you were kind of thrust into a scene or a genre, and were there thoughts around it? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Initially, for sure. I mean, we were definitely a product of the hardcore scene. There's no question about it.
Hey, if you need an exciting new record to look forward to, Iodine Recordings, the Boston-based record label, is releasing the 30th anniversary edition of Quicksand's classic debut, Slip, on vinyl. This is the album's first time on vinyl in over a decade, with completely remastered sound. This deluxe gatefold edition with slipcase comes with a poster, a deluxe LP, and a 64-page hardcover book. The book chronicles the album's history and has commentary from Anthrax, Hole, Rise Against, Youth of Today, Papa Roach, and more. Experience this iconic post-hardcore record in a brand new way with the 30th anniversary edition of Quicksand's Slip, available for pre-order now and in stores on March 31st, 2023. And since they returned in 2021, Iodine Recordings has released almost 20 albums to date from bands like Stretch Armstrong, The Darling Fire, One Line Drawing, Jerome's Dream, Soaker Fire, and more. Head on over to iodinerecordings.com for more, and follow them on Instagram at Iodine Recordings.
You know, that's how we met, and those were where a lot of our influences came from, or at least, you know, post-hardcore bands or melodic hardcore bands. When we did our first 7-inch on Crisis Records, and then when it was time for us to do our first LP, Jordan Cooper at Revelation asked us straight up. He's like, do you want your album to be on Crisis, or do you want it to be on Revelation? It's your choice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we were like, what do we do? Cause we knew, like, we weren't, you know, we probably weren't going to mesh all that well with bands like Youth of the Day and Gorilla Biscuits and Judge. Even though we liked them, we knew we had a different kind of sound. But we also knew that there was definitely a bigger reputation with Revelation, and you know, the Crisis was like a fledgling offshoot label, and so we were thinking, well, maybe this would be more helpful for us if we just kind of bit the bullet and said, all right, we're going to be a Revelation band, and we'll just have to deal with it if people get upset that we don't have any, you know, mosh beats or whatever. And it definitely happened, because when we get booked shows, it was, hey, new Revelation Records, Farside. And once in a while it would happen. It's like, you guys don't sound straight edge hardcore. And we're like, well, we're not.
I just think of, like, a kid going up to the show on the side of the stage, and, like, he's like, new Rev band, I'm going to be on it, I'm going to get in this thing. And you guys start playing, and there's no, like, part for him to jump. That's where I just,
yeah, exactly.
I want to experience that again.
Yeah. There were plenty of those shows early on where there'd be a lot of dudes who had X's on their hands, and they'd be right up front with their arms folded, and they'd be like, yeah, come on, man. And then I bring out an acoustic guitar, and la, 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 la. You need to see the look of disappointment on their faces. But way more times than not, and I'm not patting myself on the back, way more times than not, you start to see the heads start to nod along with the beat a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right, all right, that's pretty cool. But then you'd still get the play faster, you know, yell from the back of the room once in a while. But again, one of those laughable moments where it's like, dude, you're not going to insult me.
Like, how did you guys deal hilarious? With that? How did you deal with that?
You just laugh it off, you know, you have to, you just laugh it off, you know, that's it. Don't take it seriously, but don't take it too seriously. Yep. You know, put your heart and soul into it. But at the end of the day, you got to go home and study for your exam the next morning. So,
right. Yeah. You had other shit you're dealing with.
Or go to work or whatever. It's like, you just showed up to play some music and have fun. And
who did you connect with from a band or a person perspective outside of the band? Like, were there other people that saw you guys and were like, oh, let's go do this? Or I mean I've heard that a lot of stories where, you know, the odd one out finds the other odds.
As far as like one person in particular, if you want to make it a love fest, Jeff Caudill from Game Face and I have been insanely good friends for more than 30 years now. And he was definitely someone that, on a personal level and on a musical level, I connected with very, very early on. And that's just never wavered. We played it was really, really early on. And we played a garage show, in Irvine, California. And after we played, he and I went up to each other and it was like, hey, I like your band. Hey, I like your band. Cool, let's hang out. And that was, and that's it. Certain people you can just connect with and become friends with. And he and I still talk multiple times a week. And we've been able to collaborate together here and there on various projects. And Farsight and Game Face played a lot of shows together throughout the 90s.
You found a kinship in a different sound in a place that was supposed to be one sound.
That happened numerous times, that exact thing that you described. I don't want to take any credit for anything. We were just doing what we wanted to do, and we were happy to be there. Always so appreciative of anybody, whether they were, I was grateful then and I'm grateful now that I got to do it.
Why did the band last so long?
Probably because, we were busy with other things. If you think about it, we were together for 10 or 11 years. But we didn't put out that many records and we didn't go on that many tours. And a lot of it was because, we were all going to school, and then you have jobs and you start to get more and more responsibilities as you get deeper and deeper into adulthood. And so it took longer and longer for us to write music and record records and play shows, and we weren't all living in the same place at the same time, but we didn't have any reason not to do the band because we still liked each other. But then you could say, yeah, it's like 3 years between records or something like that. So I think that's why we were able to call ourselves a band for as long as we did, because we just took a long time to do stuff. The expectations were not always mutual by any means. It was just life. It was just there's a big difference from when you're 20 years old to when you're 25 years old to when you're 30 years old. Things just change. And it tends to get difficult to have everybody on the same page at the same time. And we tried to roll with it as best we could, for as long as we could.
If someone hasn't revisited Farsight or has never heard, what are three songs that you would tell them to listen to?
I would say Audience, which is on our Rigged album. Statues of Snow, which is on our album, The Monroe Doctrine. And I Hope You're Unhappy, which is also on The Monroe Doctrine.
Can you talk about that song a little bit more? What life is that thing had? It's crazy.
Well, I keep getting asked about it. So yeah, it's had a long one. I don't do it that often, but occasionally I'll play solo acoustic shows, and I pretty much can't not get off the stage without me being demanded to play that song, even though it's one of my absolutely least favorite songs to play live.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that. I love that you have to do it and you hate it.
I like listening to the recording. I don't like me having to do it. Like, I'm sweating bullets because I can't play guitar like I used to. I can't sing like I used to. And I want to go lay down immediately after playing it. And I always make some sort of mistake on the guitar while I'm playing it. But I just try to be as sincere and balls out about it as possible.
I like that.
I can definitely tell you that when I wrote it, and this is, you know, before you had access to things like GarageBand and cell phones, and you could just, you know, quickly record a little demo at home and message it to the other people in your band and say, hey, what do you guys think of this? You had to like write it and then show up to practice and sheepishly play it in front of your bandmates and say, okay guys, so here's this thing I wrote and let me know what you think. And I thought it was like 50-50 either way. They might like it. They might think it's totally lame, but anyway, I wrote it, so I'm going to give it a shot. And luckily they were like, very cool. You know, again, like similar to my first tryout with the band, it wasn't like, dude, that's the best song I've ever heard. It was, yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I guess we could, should be all right.
It seems to be a theme.
It's a theme with Farside, yeah. And so we just kind of worked on it and did some tinkering around with it, and then started playing it live, and then we eventually recorded it, and Jim Monroe gave it his nod of approval and said, yeah, that's a good song. I'm like, okay. You don't know what's going to affect the listener. Yeah. You can think you wrote the best song in the world, and compared to something that you just like literally farted out in an hour. And many times your audience is going to say, yeah, that one that you said you just made up like 5 seconds ago, I like that better than the one you agonized 3 months over.
Right.
Yeah. So that happens. Didn't know that people were gonna like it. I didn't know my band was gonna like it. Didn't know any person listening was gonna like it.
Well, they still are.
Yeah. And again, you don't know what you're doing when you're doing it. You just do it.
Yeah.
It's great that it connected with so many people and it resonated with so many people. I can assure you that's never been any kind of a goal. You know, like, I'm going to write a song that's going to make the entire world change, or it's going to make the chicks cry and the dudes are going to be like, it's like, nah, just see what we can come up with. And it's kind of crazy to me that it mattered to anyone.
I love that. Do you remember hearing the word emo for the first time?
Mm-hmm.
Well, where was it? What'd you think?
It was just like in the 80s. Like for me, at least, it was, it had a different, connotation, cause at least for us in the Orange County, hardcore scene, it was called emo core, and it was bands like, Dag Nasty was probably one of the biggest references. Like when the Can I Say record came out, it's like, yeah, it's kind of hardcore, pretty much hardcore, but the singer can actually sing. So that's how I always looked at it. And many people referred to us as an emo core band, in those early days. And then it took on a completely different definition that I don't know if I ever really understood.
That's okay. I've spent
not that I'm insulting anybody, but
absolutely
it's like,
not.
How do you even define punk? You know,
exactly. Like
it's pretty broad.
It's pretty broad. Yeah, and as punk evolve, more things, more offshoots, more understanding. Mm-hmm. So what happened after Farside? Was it for you? Was it work? Was it other musical projects? Or what did you kind of get into after?
Really, just worked. I mean, at that point, I was like 30, 31 years old. It was. Working as a magazine editor and pretty well rooted into adulthood. I did nothing. I started taking voiceover classes and started eventually doing that for a living. Had a brief stint playing for the Aquabats.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think that was around 2006 or 2007. Cause I was getting, I was realizing after several years that I didn't really enjoy being a magazine editor that much. And so I was able to go play music full time for, I think about a year. And then that ended. And then I just, and then that's when I started doing voiceover work and started doing that full time. And
what was that like? What was that like being kind of leaving something that you had been in for a while to do something new? What was that like?
I mean, being a musician to a magazine editor to a musician to a voice actor kind of thing. I was a journalism major in college because I thought it would be a really good merging of creativity and also practical skills, and after about 10 years it just felt like any other dumb job that I had had in high school or while I was a college student. Like you're just ultimately doing what somebody else is telling you to do. And I also realized I don't really like writing very much. Like I never have. I like editing other people's work. I don't like writing things.
Hmm.
Oh my God. When I write lyrics, I agonize over every little syllable. I had a friend who was a voiceover coach who had told me multiple times, you know, you have a nice voice and you have a nice way of speaking. And, if you ever want to come to a class sometime, just pop on in. And I went and I got hooked. And so I took classes off and on for a little while and recorded a demo and eventually got an agent and did some hustling and actually started making money at it and made a living for about 15 or 16 years doing that.
Amazing. Just doing
various project. Yeah, I will admit, I know, if you're a religious person, you would know that this is a sin, but I was so incredibly proud of myself that I could call myself a working voice actor and I didn't have to have a survival job. I didn't make a lot of money, but I made enough to have a relatively comfortable existence. I lived in a nice apartment in a nice neighborhood and it was pretty great while it lasted.
Is that still going on or is that something that you've changed and done something else?
I live in Pennsylvania now. And so when I met my now wife and I moved out here, I had to take into consideration that there was a very big possibility that may not be doing a lot of voiceover work anymore.
Right.
But I was willing to take that gamble and that's kind of what happened. It just sort of dried up. COVID did not help.
Absolutely not.
One bit.
Right.
So I still do I'll still do smaller freelance jobs here and there, and I just record them at home to make a few extra bucks. And I really enjoy it when I get those opportunities to do those things. Part of not being in Los Angeles is because I did a lot of video game work,
mm-hmm.
and I did a lot of post-production work on movies and television shows. And those are things that you just can't do remotely.
Right.
Or it's really, really difficult to do because they want you to be in the same studio as all the other voice actors who are doing it. So everybody's using the same microphone and being in the same
mm-hmm.
room. I do miss it, but I don't regret moving here at all.
Can you say what you're doing now?
I am an assistant to a school psychologist.
Oh, amazing.
Yes. Who also happens to be one of my bandmates.
That's great.
In my new band.
So you like the gig?
Yeah, it's great. Money's fantastic. I get to work at home, flexible hours. We can work remotely, and so he's like, come on, man, think of it. Like, we'll go on tour or go play a festival and we just bring our laptops and we can still get our work done. Like, that is like super hardcore adult. That is so 2023, middle-aged and above hardcore.
Totally. Right. Absolutely. And so did you go to school for it, or was it just something that you...
Oh, no, I know nothing. I know nothing about education or psychology. But I do have a lot of work experience and administrative skills, and also my journalism background. You know, I know how to communicate well with people.
Yeah.
I do what he tells me and happily do it. And yeah.
So then you're talking about the new band. Is that would be Calling Hours, correct?
Correct.
Talk about that.
The Calling Hours is a group of guys who live in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They were all the members of the band Don't Sleep, which featured Dave Smalley as their lead singer, and they mm-hmm. had an album out on Victory Records. Those guys have known each other forever, and we played a show together. I was doing a solo acoustic thing, and this was a little over a year ago. And they just kind of hit me up and said, hey, would you be interested in doing a few full band songs together? Because we're fans. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So we did a few Far Side songs and some covers. And then we were just kind of chatting afterwards, and they said, yeah, we just kind of get together and jam every once in a while, and we've got some songs that wouldn't really work for Don't Sleep, and we don't really know what to do with them, and we're looking for a singer. And I kind of sheepishly rose my hand and said, well, I'm not really doing anything. Can I try out? same with the same amount of confidence that I had when I asked to try out for Far Side.
Did you bring the tape deck too to record while you went to the bathroom?
I probably should
have. Voice. You just left your phone on voice memo.
I wish.
Next time.
But they were receptive to it, and they were like, yeah, well, we've got a ton of stuff. We'll just start emailing you songs, and if you like it, write some lyrics, record them at home if you want, or whatever, no big deal. When they did the Don't Sleep record, they had worked with Brian McTernan, and one of the guys mentioned to Brian, and Brian and I are very, very old friends. And one of them mentioned to Brian, hey, we're doing this thing, and it sounds like, you know, Popeye wants to sing for us. And Brian immediately said, book a studio and let's record some songs like now.
And no way.
Yeah, it happened really, really.
That fucking rules.
Kind of quickly, yeah. I know, and it's Brian freaking McTernan, man. It felt like it was really quick. To me, it did. It felt like it. But we met up in Harrisburg at this at a studio, and we just demoed a few songs over the course of a couple of days, and we all agreed that we were going to go forward with this. And then we just kept doing more of it. We had a couple more demo sessions, and then we recorded all the stuff for our record that's going to be coming out on Revelation, and it's mixed, it's mastered, it's in the pipeline, as they say. And so yeah, we're super, super anxious for it to be out there and available. It's going to feel like an eternity before that actually happens, because we want it out there now. We're finally able to start, like, kind of like, okay, the record's done. Now maybe we can start playing some shows. So we do have a show coming up on May 20th in Harrisburg with the legendary Shades Apart. So we're super, super jazzed about that, and that'll be our first time on stage, and I already got butterflies about it. I have zero things to complain about, honestly.
With I love
music
that.
Or otherwise, like, it's I had a lifetime worth of memories by the time I was 35, you know, and now I'm much older than that. I'm still making new memories and still getting to have new experiences. Like, what could I possibly complain about? If you think about how many people are on this planet and never get to do this kind of stuff, like, it's a really, really, really small percentage of people that get to play music live and record music and travel and
friendships.
I was just going to say, all the friends I've made, like, it's just, it's innumerable. Like, I literally cannot go through a single day without some random memory or thought popping into my head about something or somebody that I met, or a conversation that I had, or a show that we played, or anything. Like, it's impossible for that to not happen every day, at least once. So, you know, how could you not feel anything other than gratitude about it?
It's getting late. I know that you're in your bed, and as much as I would like to join you, I'll be standing instead. If only for a token display, I would like to keep my conscience clean.
X-rays, penicillin, even chemotherapy were all pioneered at the Yale School of Medicine, the very same medical school that's affiliated with Yale New Haven Health. This unique combination of medical advancements and personalized care is why many of the best minds in medicine all choose to work at Yale New Haven Health, and why more and more people in this region choose to be treated here. Yale New Haven Health, with the greatest of care.
America's number one motorcycle insurer is ready to ride. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year. And they keep things affordable with discounts like Paid in Full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. Get a quote today at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Premium is for state minimum liability coverage. Rate and discounts not available in all states or situations.